I'm Thorne Dreyer, and you got Rag Radio right here. Rag Radio is a comes your way every Friday. It's a syndicated radio show that comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. on KOOP in Austin, an all-volunteer, solar-powered, cooperatively run community radio station. And then we were later rebroadcast on a number of other stations, and our podcasts are, they have legs, Tracy.
Yeah. Get around a little bit.
A lot of people listen to the show in a lot of different ways. The show is streamed live on KOOP.org. So keep that in mind for the future. We are produced in conjunction at the studios of Co-op in conjunction with the Rag Blog and the New Journalism Project. So lots of stuff going on. Tracy Schultz is my engineer.
Yeah,
aren't you?
Yeah, I think so.
Roger Baker's taking pictures. Great. Good. Ciotti's taking pictures. I mean, there's just all this activity in here. There's often a lot of activity in here. And my guest is the wonderful, the one and only Pedro Gatos, who is also, I identified him as a radio journalist, but he hosts a show here on Co-op. We're going to talk about Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution, and part of what we're going to do is to try to separate fact from fiction. We will address, among other things, the significance of the Cuban Revolution to Latin America and the disenfranchised around the world, the history and impact of U.S.-Cuban relations on the revolution, Cuba's healthcare system and the principle of internationalism, Cuba's role in defeating South African apartheid, and the issue of political prisoners and human rights violations. We'll be getting into that too. Pedro Gatos, for the past 15 years, has hosted a weekly national and international news and analysis show, Bringing Light into Darkness, which is on Co-op 91.7 FM in Austin. At what time? When? This is Pedro Gatos, by the way. Hey, dude.
Hey, let me just share first, Thorne, it's just a great honor, and I really appreciate having the opportunity to share time with you on Rag Radio, you know, one of our great news and public affairs programs. Bringing Light into Darkness is on Mondays from 6 to 7 p.m.
6 to 7 p.m.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I will finish before we get started also, because I want to say a little more about you, and that is that you're a frequent visitor to Cuba as a reporter and researcher. Gatos has interviewed former President of the National Assembly and UN Ambassador Ricardo Alarcón, and Center of Immunology Director Dr. Carlos Laje, and has also interviewed sports and radio journalists, musicians, Cuban citizens, CIA officer Philip Agee, and Cuban double agents. His most recent trip was a research project to study Cuba's healthcare system and its principle of medical internationalism as an alternative to neoliberal policies, during which he attended the week-long International 2015 Cuba Health Convention. Okay, once more, welcome to Rag Radio. And this is such an incredible topic, incredibly important topic right now. And there's so much out there in the media. When Fidel died, I mean, you got stuff just way across the board in terms of coverage. Mm-hmm. We had two wonderful articles that we ran on the Rag Blog, one by the marvelous, the wonderful Margaret Randall, poet and author who spent 11 years in Cuba in the 70s, and also by James McIntyre, wow, who writes from Quito. Margaret Randall said, "The Cuban Revolution stood up to a world power many times its size and strength, put basic human needs on its agenda, all but eradicated illiteracy, and soon achieved a ninth grade education for all adults, guaranteed universal health care and good free public education from kindergarten through the postgraduate level, worked to provide adequate housing for all, and made full employment a reality. Institutionalized racism and sexism were eradicated, and progress was made against their holds on people's minds and hearts. Citizens discussed and passed new law. Book publishing was subsidized. Culture and sports events were free." And and a lot more. I mean, she talks about it on many different levels. But James McIndoe, his headline was "Vultures Over Havana," and he said when Fidel Castro died in his sleep at 90 on November 25th in Havana, American news consumers might have been forgiven for thinking he was slain in battle. Today, this is Donald Trump, who said, "Today the world marks the passing of a brutal dictator who oppressed his own people for nearly six decades." McIndoe talks about the Daily Beast, John Avalon, who called Castro a bully and a thug. In an article, "Fidel Castro Finally Dies," the Daily Beast, John Avalon, excoriates Castro as a bully and a thug, the latest in a long line of self-interested opportunists who rule through fear and pretend that it is love. He says that when the full story of Castro's personal enrichment and paranoid hold on power for more than a half century at the expense of individual rights and individual life becomes better understood, those folks who fell for the combination of political myth and personal charisma, blah, 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 will have been exposed as enablers to his tropical tyranny.
Blah, blah, blah.
Blah, 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 blah. Right. But I give you those two, because it shows some of the range, and as you pointed out, even on the left, there's a whole range of views about the Cuban Revolution. Why don't we start right there? About the contradictions in public perception, and we can start at in the beginning here, unraveling a little of that and see what's, because you're a student of Cuba, you've done a lot of research, you've been there half a dozen times at least, and spent substantial time there, and you've given presentations on Cuba, so. How do we reconcile these perceptions?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, perceptions are the result of information that's made available to us and information that's not made available to us, or information we make available to ourselves and information we do not. And so you're absolutely right that the perception, it's like people feel like balanced news is if you have 50% negative and 50% positive. I think balanced news is when you try to get at the truth.
Right.
And I think when you look at in Cuba, for instance, overwhelmingly the population, I mean, just overwhelmingly is grieving the loss of Fidel Castro. And that is because he was, despite, you know, people that call themselves journalists and speak to these issues of these tyrannical types of things he enriched himself. I think Forbes magazine came out with an article in 2005 or 2006 claiming Fidel was one of the top 10 richest people in the world. And Fidel immediately said, you know, you show me $1 that I have in any foreign bank account or any amount of money of that nature, I resign today. You know, so people can make these remarks. I think so I do think that trying to get at the issues that are measurable, and I think that they are measurable when you start comparing them to other countries in the same area of the world and in the developing world and that type of thing, to how Cuba existed before the revolution, post revolution, and you try to judge, you know, the issues on those merits.
Okay, well, why don't we step back? Why was there a Cuban Revolution? If we talk about all this tyranny, what were things like before the revolution? What were things like under Batista?
Mm-hmm.
And why didn't we hear about that?
Yeah, and that's the point, exactly, that as long as you're under the tutelage of and being controlled and allowing almost unlimited investment capital to go into these countries, there's no problem. But when you go into a country and you start taking the resources and those types of things and prioritizing the interests of the majority of people of that population, that means you are reducing the profit margin of those investors. And then this avalanche of propaganda, of the negativity comes in. Not to say that there has not been mistakes and those types of things. But John Kennedy... These are his words. At the beginning of 1959, U.S. companies owned 40% of, and of course, 59 would have been just the birth of the revolution. U.S. companies owned about 40% of the Cuban lands, almost all the cattle ranches, 90% of the mines and mineral concessions, 80% of the utilities, and practically all the oil industry, and supplied 2/3 of Cuba's exports. And so some of these oil companies, this is JFK, mind you, some of these oil companies then, there was no oil refineries in Cuba that were not foreign-owned, okay? And then when they imported Russian oil, they refused to refine it. You know, so that led to the Cuban government, led by Fidel, saying, well, if you're not going to refine this oil, we need it, you know, we're going to nationalize you. And that's what they did. So you don't hear those things. You hear instead stories about how they stole all this money. Nationalization is a process that historically you can look at in many scenarios and see what type of compensation that businesses got, and what's acceptable and what's generally not acceptable. Cuba was very generous in its offers, and the proof of that is that at least a half a dozen or more nations settled with the U.S. offer. Only the United States did not.
With the Cuban offer.
That's right. That's right.
Right. James McIntyre wrote, he said, before Fidel Castro took power in 59, Cuba suffered under generations of U.S.-backed dictatorships that kept 60 to 70% of Cubans in poverty. Mm-hmm. So the island was a U.S. tourist vassalage and sugar plantation, starting in 1898 when the Americans drove out the Spanish.
So first of all, the Americans did not drive out the Spanish. The Cubans
drove out the
Spanish. Through revolutionary efforts,
right,
beginning in the mid-1800s, 1868 to, and I may be missing these, but there was a, you know, the first revolution was in the 1860, that's about 10 years. The second one culminated in 1898. They had run them out. That was the bombing of the Maine. The Maine was down
into
the harbor there from the United States. And just as Cuba was liberating itself, people argue that that there was a sabotage intentionally done to it by Western interests, by U.S. interests, to give a pretext to stay down there. And what they did is they usurped the victory, and they had our troops down there, and they also eventually, what was it, 1901, the Platt Amendment was agreed to under duress. It was not agreed to by Cubans, but by Cubans that were put into positions of power by the U.S. interests, and then agreed ultimately to what culminated in 1903, this agreement with Guantanamo, right, among other things, where the U.S. could come in at any time to assert, you know, their authority. But of course, Guantanamo, from 1903 on, has been leased from the United States. And to the point of Guantanamo, when the revolutionary victory in 1959 came to power, they did not recognize that treaty because, as we said, it was under duress, and they refused to accept any payments. And that government has not accepted any payments since its initial refusal, I think, in 1959.
Okay. The consummate marionette was an army sergeant named Fulgencio Batista, who led a military coup. He enriched himself and suspended civil liberties, and when his popularity waned, he brought in the U.S. mob to open casinos and help run interference with his own people. U.S. corporations loved him, but Cubans hated him. He stayed in power using more drastic measures, including coups, whatever. The situation in Cuba was desperate. And the changes were dramatic, weren't they?
Yeah, and so if you actually back up, Thorne, to 1953, which is really where it's the most famously celebrated historical event in revolutionary Cuba, July 26th. And in 1953, of July 26th, the Cubans led by Fidel and a number of other people tried to take over the Moncada garrison, which is all the way at the other end of the island of Cuba. Okay, and they it's the largest garrison outside of Havana, Okay. In 1952, you mentioned there was a coup.
Right.
But before that, Fidel Castro, you know, as a lawyer, a very active student, he was running for office along with another people. In fact, Fidel's first party, he was with the Authentic Party. You know, people don't even know that. You know, so this idea that he was always a communist and these labels, to me, are really, it's a shiny coin thing. You know, as opposed to labels, what are the policies that are presented, and do they have substance? Do they have merit, rather than just labeling stuff? But he was with the Authentic Party, and he was known to not be committed in any form or fashion to what later radicalized him towards more, you know, more leftist position or whatever. And they were going to win. I mean, the polling was such that it looked like they were going to take these offices, and I forget which one he was running for. But then there was the coup. So, you know, I think it's important, you know, that Fidel, as a lawyer, was seeking to change from within. You know, you start evaporating all these different ways to address these issues that you mentioned quite appropriately, the incredible poverty and disproportional wealth type of thing. And then in this Moncada garrison was horrifically failed. They all got arrested. Most of them got killed. And then Fidel presented his own defense and says, I'm not, you know, he said Batista's government was the one that should be on trial, not me. They did the coup. And then in this manifesto, the Moncada manifesto, he laid out rural reform, education, health care, literacy issues, on and on and on. Just said this is what we were going to do if we succeeded in the Moncada. And then if you look at the first few years of the revolution, just one after another, those things were done. I mean, that's, you know, a matter of historical record.
Okay. Maybe this would be a good time to take a break, Tracy. Are you prepared for that? Okay. We're talking with Pedro Gatos about the Cuban Revolution. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio. Tracy just told me we're back, and I didn't want to come back. I wanted to just listen. What is that, Pedro?
You know, I just I think Tracy has it right there, but it's a song called Manteca by Obakowa, and I've never heard the band before. It's from a CD I picked up called Cuban Funk Experience. Obviously, it is a driving Afro-Cuban drum beat. And I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, with slavery and everything that went on with it, hundreds of thousands of African slaves were brought to Cuba. And as a consequence, I believe there Afro-Cubans make up some 30% or more of the Cuban culture.
We're talking about the death of Fidel Castro, and we're looking at the Cuban Revolution from a number of different angles. And I wanted to. Margaret Randall wrote, Fidel redefined what it means to be Latin American and Caribbean. Mm-hmm. bringing the dreams of Bolivar and Martí into the 20th century. She said he taught altruism by example. Cuba suffered severe scarcities of material goods, yet was always ready to share what it had with others facing greater crises or undergoing tougher circumstances. In what way did, because he became an example for the entire hemisphere, for Latin America, for underprivileged people around the world, in what we called the Third World. How was that? How did that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's really gets at the crux of trying to understand if you want to believe that Castro was an absolute tyrannical murderer, or was he this revolutionary that was trying to lead an example towards alleviating misery that's created by the exploitation of other people and that type of thing, and so. You know, with his, the focus of the Cuban Revolution from the very beginning was internationalism. It's just a principle. I think Algeria was the first internationalist mission in 1960, but there is a whole, decades. You know, there's now what we're into the sixth decade of internationalist missions and such. But you mentioned Simón Bolívar, okay? And Simón Bolívar's, his vision was to unite Latin America into a, just like the United States of America, the United States of Latin America, I think would be an adequate way that all people, but the difference, of course, would be that, all of these people's needs should be, should be addressed. And I might just add that that's also, and I don't mean to go off on a tangent here, but...
Go off on a tangent.
Okay. It's important because none of this makes sense if you don't apply it to today. And in Libya, the Libyan government was moving towards, had a vision of United States of Africa. They were an incredibly rich nation. They had the highest human development index of any country throughout the African continent of some 54 nations, and they were actively working towards trying to bring up the welfare. And again, when you do that and try to bring up the standards of that whole nation, by definition, you are restricting the investment capital coming in without any restrictions. Just applying fair restrictions to it is a slap in the face. And so when you go back to, like, for instance, this nationalization process in Cuba or in Guatemala, as I know you're familiar with Guatemalan history under Jacoby Arbenz, what happened to United Fruit is they were offered the money and value for their land that they had claimed that their land was worth for 40 years before. They were knowingly underpaying their tax value of their deal, stealing from that country, like they weren't getting enough, benefits. And then when they were held accountable for actually saying, oh, this is what it's worth, this is what we'll give you, and they go, oh, no, it's worth a lot more than that now that we're getting, nationalized, that type of thing. So anyhow, going back to this internationalist kind of principle, it's actually in the Cuban constitution, the most recent constitution that was done after the turn of the century and such. And it was felt that Cuba benefited from the help of other nations, certainly not the United States, but other nations. And it was important to, to reach out in that regard. And so if you look at the number of countries that they have been involved in, it's over 100 nations of the world. There's only 180, one nations at the UN.
When you say that they've been involved in, mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, at different levels, I think most famously would be the medical level. Okay, and let me just preface this by saying there's a big difference between giving a country thousands or millions of vaccines, which is important, and teaching a nation how to develop a healthcare system that is appropriate to or like the one in Cuba, where they have the lowest infant mortality rate in the whole hemisphere. You know, they have the longest life expectancy of any of these nations that nobody thinks is tyrannical.
Right.
You know, those types of things. But to your point, Cuba, this is like from the notes that I was taking from that 2015 health fair. They were already stationed in 66 nations with over 50,000 physicians, nurses, and health technicians. Throughout the years, over 207 million medical appointments had been done, nearly 2.3 million childbirths delivered, 8 million surgeries, the immunization of over 12 million children and women. This Operation Miracle, which you may be familiar with, it was with the Chavez government. This is kind of like a south-to-south cooperation, now has been spread to 35 nations. So Cuba and Venezuela had reached some 2.9 million have recovered their eyesight, and 35,000, 36,000 from Africa alone. Much of the loss of eyesight, much of the misery of this world is just malnutrition and just, you know, just outright, you know, exploitation or supporting governments that are ruthless in the way they don't you know, allow their folks to live. So you go blind if you don't eat right, you know, and these types of things. So those are two examples of just some of the medical. The last thing, real quick, they have built a medical school in Cuba, okay, and that's now graduated tens of thousands of doctors, over 10,000 doctors, okay? And not only that, they have gone to countries in, like, two or three countries in Africa and built medical schools there and helped actually staff them. So they are teaching countries how to create the infrastructure of health that you have to have for long term.
How were they able to do this? How were they able to go from zero to 100? Like that, You know, how did they make that happen? Not only transforming the Cuban healthcare system, but having that effect internationally.
That's another just great question. I think therein lies the difference in, you know, the principles and the cultural fabric of and desires, you know, away from a materialism thing towards a cooperative, you know, a humanitarian. I mean, you think about Che, who is a doctor, you know, as well. It's just a whole priority of values that's just a little bit different, okay? And so, you know, the doctors in Cuba, you know, clearly, like everyone else, is way underpaid. You know, it's very tough life in Cuba, but they're living longer. You know, they have access to what I think people don't get is they have cultural access. They have access to ballets. They have access to, these are just 1 or 2 pesos for them, 5 or 10 cents. They can go to aquariums, ballets, baseball games, art museums, and all of this. Very, very high culture, but they're very poor. And guess what? If you're a doctor and you go and become part of these medical international missions, you get quite a bit more compensation. Not nearly.
There's incentive.
There is incentive, and they go. But guess what? You know, 99% of them or 95% of them come back. And you know what we do in our country? We go and we approach these doctors and we try to get them to come to the United States. There's a whole program. Can you imagine? All of these poor people are getting their needs met that never got them met before. Millions of people throughout the world, mainly by this Cuban-led program. And other nations, by the way, are involved with these things too. And here we are, again, at every turn, trying to demonize Cuba, trying to make them look worse by saying, look at all these doctors that are, you know, that are leaving, that aren't coming back and stuff. And they're actually getting getting paid. And of course, some people just like the United States is the most richest nation in the world, and in the view of many, many people throughout the world, that's where they want to be. You know, it has nothing to say negative about Cuba. It's where all people want to be, you know, based on, you know, these images that are created throughout the world.
I guess the priorities in medicine are different too. Mm-hmm. They're not in they're towards basic services, right?
Yeah.
And not towards, you know, highly developed, technologically advanced curative kind of programs. I mean, they're
It's both though, actually. But you're right. I mean, you know what people don't understand is when to have the lowest infant mortality rate. That's not like, oh wow, that, you know, they just want to do that to look good. No, you have to have the best nutrition.
Well,
you have to have the best sanitation. You have to have the best education. You have to. There's so many things that have to go along kind of with that. And with the embargo, Fidel, again, this is a guy that. Brilliant man. If you ever read his speeches, he will make analogies in medicine, in, you know, almost in physics and stuff. He's just a very knowledgeable kind of person. But he saw very early that we are going to need to make Cuba, that is, our own medicines due to the embargo. And so they invested not just in, they've got, 10 or 11 vaccinations that they give their children there, but they also invested very heavily in biotechnology. And some of these inventions that they now have in the international market are medical, there's medical capital coming in based on this biotechnological, you know, developments and such. But you're right, their first priority is the nutritional and healthcare needs of the people in Cuba. Just the last thing with the women, you're not allowed to have, my understanding, a birth outside of a hospital. Okay, so they have three tiers of healthcare. One is the family, you know, neighborhood family doctor kind of thing, where most happens. It's all preventative. And so if you're pregnant, I mean, I know you wouldn't be pregnant, but a woman that isn't,
know.
A woman that is pregnant is going to be seen more frequently as she gets closer to her birth date, you know, and such. And the nutrition, and even during that period of time that you were talking about when Russia collapsed in 1989, early 90s and such, they prioritized, guess what? The limited people were losing all of this weight, all of this stuff. These are Cubans I've spoke to that are very good friends of mine, losing 30, 40 pounds. But what they do is they prioritize that the milk goes to the women that are pregnant and to the kids, and they guarantee the most basic nutritional values. Fidel knows about nutrition. The first 2 years to 4 years of life, if you're not properly nourished, your cerebral, your brain capacity, potentiality is irrevocably compromised, and that is the sad thing. It's not just the people that starve in the world; it's the people that exist in, if not a miserable state, at least a compromised state that's just not necessary.
Okay, the Cuban Revolution happens. It's an incredibly idealistic vision that Fidel Castro had for, and obviously there was. Much of it was accomplished, and accomplished it in a remarkably short period of time. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about history. We're talking about a country that was, that was demonized by the United States, which of course had controlled the entire hemisphere. And the embargo and the other. Actions of the U.S. government, you know, certainly made the revolution more difficult, but it also made it necessary to be more consolidated, more centralized, or perhaps more, some of the things that people criticize the government for happened, did they not, partly because the revolution had to be preserved in the face of all of this outside pressure.
Well, and that's the point. Again, if you don't look at the context of a situation, then you can't possibly make a fair comparison. I mean, we have some good friends in this room right now, and if me and Tracy were going to have a race, and unbeknownst to the world, I tied, you know, 2 50-pound weights, one on his left foot and one on his right foot, and we're going to run a 50-yard, you know, dash. He'd probably still beat me, but not by, but by not by as much, you know. And that's the context thing. So getting to your point, what most Americans do not appreciate, and this is totally a validated, fact-based history of hundreds and hundreds of sabotage and forms of introducing biological warfare into Cuba since 1959. Stuff, not just the firebombing of sugarcane crops, you know, not just the swine pig flu that wiped out almost all of the pigs of Cuba, which was the main deal. They had biological types of attacks that also went after poultry, went after the sugarcane smut, created sugarcane smut. All of these things, every possible kind of way, besides, you know, like the Bay of Pigs of physically invading and these types of things, so that so much of Cuba's resources had to be geared towards trying to protect and disarm these mercenary groups too. I mean, in the early part of the revolution, up until the 60s or so, you know, you're talking about thousands of people that were coming into the country and hooking up with counter-revolutionaries and this type of stuff, and just, you know, doing, you know, sabotage types of acts and such. So if you look at the, you know, countries like Guatemala under Arbenz specifically, and then later in 73 with Allende, you know, what happens is these people like Che, of course, who wasn't around in 73, but and Fidel, they studied what happens and how other revolutions had failed, how they had ultimately succumbed and been reversed, and so they understood that there had to be a number of civil right restrictions where I could just pull over you and ask for your ID and just make sure you weren't, you know, being involved in this and that. But this was only after the objective, these bombings, these shootings, these killings, these biological warfare things, all of these other attacks that ultimately took over 3,500 lives of Cubans, by the way, and such. So, you know, by doing that, that is repression. You know, if you don't repress, you lose the whole revolution in a sense. And there's obviously a real important balance that you don't over repress, you know, these kind of civil rights and such. And so that's an argument that people can have.
And the thing, and something that we talked about earlier is as incredibly important as it is to transform the, you know, power relationships and economic relationships, in places where there's a great amount of repression. How do we have a revolution that can maintain civil liberties, that can keep from becoming a centralized, dictator, tyrannical kind of thing? And we need to take a break, sure. But when we come back, I'd like for you to address that question. But in the meantime, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio. My guest is Pedro Gatos, and we're talking about Cuba and the revolution.
Si no me quieres, no debes confesar de que prefieres. Ya ¿qué debo hacer? Si tú no quieres comprender lo que quieras, no me importa el fin. Es mi manera, así no soy feliz. Ya.
Tracy, was that you singing?
No.
Because I was going to say you're very good. Pedro. Pedro Gatos is my guest. What were we listening to?
Well, that was Los Van Van, and they are probably the most famous of the Cuban, new wave bands and such. So they're a big hit throughout the Caribbean, I think, as well as in Cuba.
All right, we're talking about the Cuban Revolution and the legacy of Fidel Castro. And this is one of those dilemmas, and I don't think it's obviously not something that gets resolved here. But there were obviously human rights abuses, mm-hmm. serious abuses in Cuba, and some would say that they continue. The question is, revolutions have to take state power from somebody who doesn't want them to have that mm-hmm. power, and it involves redistribution of wealth. If we assume that those things are necessary, if we have to have those kind of changes in a world that's run by very, very few people at the top, where the masses of people are in great poverty and are not sharing in the wealth. If we assume that is an admirable goal, that is something that has to happen, that we have to, and we also have to assume that in the early days of a revolution, with all the outside influences the necessity to protect the revolution while it's transforming the society is necessary. How do we look at building a new state that's free and civil libertarian and whatever? How do we look at guaranteeing that happens as the state develops? How can we do that? How can that be done?
Well, I think like everything in life, you do it by trial and error. And, you study other revolutions, you study those types of things. I'm just trying to, try to put myself inside the head of whoever, how these decisions were made. You can't eliminate all human rights and claim that's a revolution. that's for sure. At the same time, though, there was all of these accusations that Cuba is this great human rights violator, that if you do not like Fidel Castro, if you do not like the Cuban Revolution, you are in jail. That's just not true. The people in jail were people that were found taking money from and favors from the U.S. government, okay, that has, through their embargo, through the Bay of Pigs, through their policy of the 60 years since the revolution and all of the years before, were the greatest, promoters of denying basic rights, that type of thing. So in my visits down to Cuba, I had already been understanding how many millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars poured into the country in order to try to create an opposition in Cuba. That's not promoting democracy, okay? That's promoting opposition in Cuba. If you take money in this country from a country that's at war with the United States, guess what? You go to jail. So I had the opportunity to visit with Alida Godinez and Alicia Zamora in 2011. These were two women that were double agents, okay? And double agent just means that the Cubans thought they were U.S. agents, when in fact, and the U.S. thought they were U.S. agents, but in fact, they were Cuban agents. And they were reporting, and they were in all of these meetings, these opposition meetings at the embassy and all these other locations. And they were eyewitnesses and video recordings and tapes of taking favors and money from the U.S. government. These were the people that were arrested and put, and put into jail and such. So it's just not true that if I think that that Fidel is wrong or that certain policies are wrong, that you are put in jail. If you actively engage in taking money from a foreign, enemy, that is a crime. Now, are people stopped on the street and maybe even arrested sometimes prove out to be totally innocent for a day or two, that type of thing that was kind of proven to be shown to be wrong and inappropriate and all that. Absolutely. And again, I think it goes to this point that you are not going to be able to, I'm not trying to rationalize, you know, the revolution is not, someone famously said, it's not a Tea Party. It is a war. You know, you are fighting against the powers that is the strongest power in the history of the world, and trying to preserve a certain style, a lifestyle, and they've made many mistakes throughout this process. So I don't mean to make it sound like they're mistake free.
Right, and one of the things the Cuban Revolution did richly was retain the culture. It did not become a tyrannical cultural. I mean, it wasn't. There was no cultural revolution to transform the way people lived. It made, but were there not abuses that were not necessary for preserving the state? Yeah. And do you agree or disagree with the fact that homosexuals in Cuba were repressed, were often jailed, and that remained, that was a continuing phenomenon?
Well, it's very clear that homosexuals in Cuba were incredibly discriminated against, and in fact, the revolutionary government were the primary promoters of that discrimination by their very policies and turning a blind eye to what was obviously going on in the culture itself. In fact, Fidel came out many years after that and apologized for it, and there's been great changes in all of that, and also transgender rights now, and those types of things. Cuba is a very macho culture.
Well, that's a friend of mine, Latin, who's in fact from Mexico. She said that she thought that the problems that this was more due to Latin American machismo than anything else.
Well, and I think it was partly. But I think the revolutionary government was absolutely negligent and didn't. You know, your job in any kind of government is to protect the rights of all your people, and they were not protected. And they were, and in fact, even with HIV, originally it was quarantined, and that's not been shown to be an appropriate human rights approach as well. Now, that's not the case anymore. And Cuba has the lowest HIV rate in the world, and they also they've eliminated mother to child HIV transmission. Based on the way they have addressed that issue and such. And so, again, I mean, there's a lot of problems of that nature. I think also the becoming way too dependent on the Russian economy, not diversifying their own, economic aptitudes or whatever, made them so overly dependent imagine the collapse of some 80% of the monies that you're getting from other countries just disappears overnight. And then you turn the screws on the embargo itself that the U.S., everyone thought, game over in the early 1990s based on those things. And a lot of that was self-inflicted by poor planning by the Cuban government.
But we can establish that there were abuses of human rights that were not necessary for protecting the revolution.
Yeah, I'm not. You hear all of these claims.
I'm not saying
all the
that
time.
That hasn't happened in every revolution. And the question is how you overcome those things and how quickly you can overcome them, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. A big thing is these revolutionary tribunals. You turn on the TV, 20,000 people were lined up from firing squads with no trials or whatever, or kangaroo courts or whatever. In fact, there were revolutionary tribunals. The people that committed the most horrendous types of crimes, one of the other side of the argument is that many of these people would have been dragged out onto the streets and hung from lampposts in the numbers of thousands of more than did, but the government
that would have happened what under
No, this would have happened if they did not create the Revolutionary Tribunals,
which
had a court. Now, people will say they're kangaroo courts or whatever, but actually the people that got tortured, if I got tortured and it was you that tortured me, and I could go to court and say, you were the one that did it, you know, da-da-da, you know, well, guess what? You know, you're walking out the door when you had other people saying the same thing type of thing. So the numbers were way over inflated, in my understanding. It was, you know, when you look at the names, it was less than 1,000. And basically, the issue there, too, is, like you said, I mean, in revolution, how many people in the French Revolution, how many people in the French Revolution were
lined up against a wall?
Yeah, or guillotined or whatever.
Or whatever,
you know the numbers approach close to 20,000 of a much smaller type of population. But people say, well, yeah, I mean, these guys deserved it or whatever. I certainly am not a favor of the death penalty or whatever. But the last thing, just real quickly about this, too, and it's kind of connected because it's a death penalty thing. But as you may know, in Angola, when, you know, Nelson Mandela is one of the dearest friends of Fidel Castro. So how could someone that intimately knows Fidel be, how could Fidel be accurately portrayed as he's been portrayed 50% of the time, yeah, if Mandela is swearing up and down that Africa, and particularly you know, apartheid South Africa, you know, demise was a direct result of their penetration there. In that deal, that apartheid South African.
That was the next question I was going to ask you, the role that Cuba played.
Well, it was in Angola. It was Angola in the 1970s. And this is like Russia was not supporting it. This is the thing that Cuba did on its own, you know. And it was asked by the government of Angola. They asked for help. They got material to build little airstrips and such as this. It's a very, very detailed plan, but at the end of the day, they had thousands and thousands, over 200,000 technicians and medical folks and you know, made their way in and out of Angola over those 10 or 15 years or whatever. But famously, in 1988, you know, led by many Cuban soldiers, the Angolan and Cubans were able to defeat the South African apartheid military in Cuito Cuenavale. It's a convergence of two rivers, a very strategic location that ultimately was the first defeat ever for apartheid South Africa Army, number one. And guess what? The first defeat of the U.S. imperialist kind of venture was the Bay of Pigs. So these two things are things, symbols that are very very important. So ultimately, with that issue, Nelson Mandela, it wasn't just the apartheid part. It was all of the medical aid and all of the selfless thing. The U.S. was asking Mandela to disown Fidel. And he says, no, you know, this country has done all this for all this time, and you asked us to abandon. You know, they were with us when no one else was, you know, that type of thing, and these other issues. But Nelson Mandela has said Cuba was a decisive factor in the defeat of apartheid South Africa in Angola. Ultimately, Namibia regained its independence based on this settlement that Cuba and Angola and South Africa had at the barrel of a gun that was led by Cuba. So that's what that was about.
Okay, we've got about 3 minutes. Why don't you quickly address the Bay of Pigs and the missile crisis?
Yeah. Well, 3 minutes. So the Bay of...
3 minutes. Keep now, well, now it's 2:45.
Yeah. Okay, right. Well, so just real quick. So a couple of things. One thing is that the Bay of Pigs was a U.S. invasion, but it was also supplemented by all of this propaganda, all of this endless involvement in Cuba trying to create an opposition. The bottom line was that overwhelmingly the Cuban people were behind the revolution, supported Fidel Castro in the revolution, and that's why the Bay of Pigs failed to succeed, straight out. they were met by militia, like me and Greg and Tracy, you know, living out there in the swamps, and all of a sudden, you know.
And you guys never got the recognition for that.
Yeah. No, these were the guys that met the invaders, initially. With the Cuban Missile Crisis, just really quickly, what people don't appreciate is after the defeat, after we promised we would not invade Cuba as a condition of the, that was generally what was being considered. The missile crisis was in 62, but before that, Operation Mongoose was initiated, which is a subsequent thing to the Bay of Pigs, and this was an invasion plan. And during this period of time, Cuba knew it was going to be likely invaded and such. It was under those types of conditions that they invited and they welcomed the missiles that Russia brought to Cuba. But the idea that Cuba just said, yeah, bring in some missiles because we don't like the U.S., you know. Cuba knows they have to pacify the United States. There's all these attempts on Fidel's life. They never once would ever try to assassinate one of our presidents because they know that was that's the pretext that we're looking for, and it was be game over and such. Right. These are principle-based things.
Okay. How will history remember Fidel Castro?
Well, his ideas and the principles that we'll be talking more about on Bringing Light into Darkness in a future show is one of the things. But the millions and millions, it's probably closer to a billion of people that have been touched by these medical programs, by these programs that never get any press, most censored types of deals over all these years, those are the ones that have been permanently affected and will always have that potentiality, you know, realize that potentiality of what can be done, not what's going on in the world, but what can actually get done.
Didn't it also the revolution and Fidel transform the geopolitical reality in the global South, specifically in Latin America?
Well, absolutely, but unfortunately, some of that is starting to get reversed again.
Well, yeah.
You know, with these constitutional coups that go on now. You know, it's just another level of coup action
The constitutional coup.
Yeah, since you can't get the majority of people to vote these people out, you do this other thing, like in Brazil and et cetera.
So. Okay, Pedro Gatos, thank you for being with us on RAG Radio. This has been very enlightening.
Thank you so much. It's been a great privilege to be on your show. Thank you.
It's always great to have you. We want to say that next week on RAG Radio, we're going to be searching for extraterrestrial life with noted UT Austin astronomy professor Neil Evans and Austin astronomer Cecilia Colomay. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio.